Okay, Boker Tov to everyone here. L'chol ha'mazinim. We read this week the Sedra of Toldos, and we can entitle the shiur this morning, Children, one word. Ah, children. So much to say about them. We can speak for hours and hours. Ve'la Toldos Yitzchak ben Avraham, Avraham holid es Yitzchak. These are the generations of Yitzchak, the son of Avraham. Avraham gave birth to a begat Yitzchak. I want to share with you this morning a few commentaries of Rav Soloveitchik on different aspects of parenting, beginning with this pasuk. It's a strange pasuk. I mean, the formulation of the pasuk is strange. Eila toldos Yitzchak ben Avraham. So by definition, Avraham holidus Yitzchak, because Avraham is the father. We've already defined Avraham as the father because Yitzchak ben Avraham. But you have to contrast that with the pasuk just a few pasukim before, right at the end of Parshas Chayisara. Similar formulation. That's a chumash. That's a sidra.
I know. I'm going to just look at this.
Okay, even the beginning is fine. Yeah. Ve'ila toldos Yishmael ben Avraham. These are the generations of Yishmael ben Avraham. It doesn't say Avram holidus Yishmael. It says Asher yolda Hagar hamitzris shivchasara l'Avraham. That Hagar, the Egyptian, the maidservant of Sarah, gave birth to four Avram. Why is there no expression of Holid here? All right. In other words, the symmetry would have been Eila Todos Yitzchak ben Avraham, Asher Yolda Sarah Ishto, Avraham. No. Sarah's left out of this. It's Avram Holidus Yitzchak. And then in the previous pasuk relating to Yishmael, it only mentions Hagar, doesn't mention Avram at all. So what happened to Avram Holid? And secondly, what's the difference between Holid and Yolda? So Rav said it's not the same word, and it has a completely different meaning. So he says, by way of introduction, that Yishmael's life was an uncomplicated one. If you think about it, here at the end of Parshas Chayisara, I should say there at the end of Parshas Chayisara, these are the generations of Yishmael. Eila Toldos Yishmael. Eila Shmos B'nei Yishmael, Yishmael B'Shmosam, L'Sol Nosam, Bechor Yishmael, Nevayos, Kedar, Adbeel, Mivsam, etc. He had 12 tribes. 12 tribes, 12 children, offspring that began to propagate even more, conquer land, spread their territorial acquisitions across Arabia. He just extended wherever he wanted to. So he had offspring, he had tribes, he had conquests, he had no struggles, he had no akedos. It's interesting, the Rav made a similar point at the end of Parshas Vayera. I think I mentioned here a number of times already. The Akedah is such a majestic story in Jewish life. And what follows it? Vayehi acher advim ra'ele, v'vgad l'Avraham le'mor, hinei yolda milka gam hi banim l'nor achor achicha. After the Akedah, Avram gets word, oh, your brother Nachar, he also had children. Utz and Booz and Kmuel and Kesed leading up to Besuel, Uvesuel Yolades Rivka. So the point is to show that there's a change in generations, that Rivka is born, and that'll help the story of Yitzchak. But the Rav said there's something else going on here. Look at all the turmoil in Avram's life. Look at all the heartache that he and Sarah went through for decades in order to have a son. And here the Torah says, Vayehi acher advim ra'ele, Vayogad l'Avram le'mor, as if he gets a text or an email. Oh, by the way, Milka gave birth. Not only one child. Banim l'nachar achicha. Your life is a turbulent one. Your brother Nachar's life is a very placid one. It's very peaceful. It's what we consider normal. What's normal? He found a wife, they got married, they had children, they had grandchildren, and life moves on. It's a simple life. With Avram, nothing is simple. And you see the same thing here with Yitzhak and Yishmael. Yishmael had a simple life. Yitzhak had the exact opposite. Everything was a struggle. Everything was a conflict. Ekeda, at the top of the list, but then you get to the fact that he had to delegate finding a wife for himself, and they got married, and they took it, we'll see in a second, it took years for them to have a child, 20 years, and then they raised their children, and their children are also beset by conflict, Yaakov and Esau. Nothing at all was simple about Yitzhak's life. And therefore, to us, it's defined as a life of sacrifice. And here, as Soloveitchik said, that really is the meaning of the covenantal community. It's not something you just join, like you join, you know, AAA, and there are no consequences, and there's no real importance to it. But rather, there's a sacrifice involved in being part of a covenantal community. And that's, in fact, why Sarah expelled Yishmael. Remember in Parshas Vayera, Sarah tells Avram he has to leave here. We have to banish him because he represents a threat to Yitzchak. What did Sarah see? She saw that Yishmael was a bad influence. He had no self-control. He had no sense of discipline. He had no spirit of sacrifice. And therefore he could not be part of that community, part of the Bris Avram. Avram, of course, was chagrined by it. But nonetheless, you see that God was maskim. God agreed that Yishmael had to be sent out. At the very root, though, of the conflict of Yitzhak and Yishmael, and the reason why Sarah saw that Yishmael was inappropriate to be to reside in the same house as Yitzhak, was this reason. Life for Yishmael was too easy, and therefore he would never be engaged in any type of... He would flee from any type of difficulty or try to overcome it with violence. Now, with that, there's another point. I should add that there's no doubt... Look, there's a whole debate whether the Arabs today are descendants of Yishmael or not. You know, they claim to be descendants of Yishmael, and it's part of their narrative, but the truth is there's 2,000 years of separation between Avram's story and the creation of Islam, so who really knows for sure? And I guess, notwithstanding this, they have they definitely have a spirit of self-sacrifice today. I have to give them that. Unfortunately, they take people along with them when they're sacrificing themselves. But nonetheless, in terms of a sacrifice for a good, for a morality, for self-control, that they really don't have. The ability to say, I will not. I will not because it's wrong. I mean, they can reclassify, but they don't have the capacity anymore to say that they're going to respect the morality or the interests or the truths of another. That they don't have. But there's something else here as well. We get back to the point. When Yishmael's tale is being told by the Torah, Vela told us Yishmael ben Avraham, Asher Yoldo Hagar HaMitzris. Yishmael's generations, Yishmael the son of Avram, it's Hagar who bore him. Yoldo, the Rav said, is biological continuity. It means you give your genes to someone. And that's what Hagar did. She gave her genes, she gave a lot more, but she gave her genes to Yishmael. Holid is something else. Holid is an educational process. It means investing in a child, not just genes, but a derech hachayim. And the difference in the words, of course, yalad, holid, it's the same root, but holid, he said, is a hey. Hey adds a dimension. Hey is a critical letter in the life of Avraham, because that's the letter that was added to his name when he went from Avram to Avraham. He became Avraham as the prelude to becoming the father of Yitzchak. Without that, he's not the father of Yitzchak. So Holid then adds a new dimension to the whole institution of parenting. And that is, parenting is not just the conveyance of genes to children, it's rather the conveyance of ideas, of values, of an education. it's not just parenting is not just the creation of offspring for purposes of work or physical continuity, which it really was in the ancient world. Why'd you have a lot of children? They should be able to work the farm, work the fields, provide for everyone else. Now that's changed. And it's changed through Avram Avinu, that his relationship to his children is not limited to the provision of genes, to the physicality, the physical nature of the offspring, but it's rather the transmission of ideas and values. I should add that now we'll understand something, why every ger, every gioris, is a ben Avram Avinu, or a bas Avram Avinu. We always use ben or bas in terms of a biological connection, right? You see, it's not so. The Rav mentions here also, a person who teaches Torah to his friend, his friend's child, it's ke'ilu yilado. A Rebbe, in many cases, the status of a father as well, because you're a parent to a child. A parent, in fact, certain cases the Gemara mentions, you know, greater respect to a Rebbe than to a parent. Don't let this get out too far. Because the parent brings you olam hazeh, but the Rebbe brings you olam haba. All right, the parent is a teacher also, that's the highest level, because that parent does both. But in fact, when we speak of a ger as ben Avram Avinu, or a gioris as bas Avram Avinu, that crystallizes the relationship that exists. It's a relationship where it's not the physical nature, it's not the DNA which governs, but it's rather the ideas and the values and the ideals and the commitment to a particular way of life, especially the ideas of God, that are at the heart of the relationship between the Jewish people and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So when the Torah says, Avram holid es Yitzchak, which is, as I noted at the very beginning, it's repetitive because we learned that from the first five words of the Pasuk that Avram was Yitzchak's father. Yeah, Yitzchak ben Avram means that Yitzchak was Avram's biological son. But Avram holid es Yitzchak means that Avram endowed Yitzchak with far more than appearance or the physical characteristics that one parent bequeaths to a child. Now, apropos of this, I'll just quote something from Harav Aviner, which is a very telling statement. So, Rashi says here, on the repetition, Avram Holidis Yitzchak, that Ayyadei Shekosav HaKosov Yitzchak Ben Avraham, who's Kak Lomar Avram Holidis Yitzchak. Once the Torah said that Yitzchak is Avram's son, it had to re-emphasize that Avram begat Yitzchak. Why? L'fisha hoyu leitzonei hador omrim me'avimelech nis'abra sara. Because the scoffers, the mockers of the generation were saying that Avimelech was Yitzchak's real father. Because you remember, Hashem Pakada Sara came right after she was liberated from Avimelech's palace. And here the two of them are childless for so many years. So Tzanim was saying, oh, Asherei kama shanim shahasa im Avraham v'lonis Abrahimenu. They lived together for decades without children. Ma sakadosh baruch hu, what did God do? Tzar klaster panav shel Yitzchak dom el Avraham. So God made Yitzchak's face, his visage, exactly like Avram's. Ve'heidu hakol Avram holidis Yitzchak. So they would say, everyone would testify, oh, yeah, Yitzchak is Ben Avram because they look alike. By the way, what is this obsession that people have when a child is born to trying to take a feature of the child and relating it to a parent or to a grandparent? Yes, you can explain that anomaly.
I read somewhere.
Yes.
I don't know how.
It can't be for the Leitzonei Hador. They're trying to prove, no, it's really my child. He has my chin.
I read somewhere that
I heard couples can start looking like each other.
Yes, that's true.
Right.
There's something about the natural, I guess, like from times before, the father wanting to know that that's really their child.
Bot.
Right. Well, look, Marissa Chazaka, you dummy. Now we have tests, but in the end, it was in the ancient world, just based on Chazaka. And you see the Chazaka here because the Leitzanim was saying, "Oh, it can't be."
But I read that somewhere, like in a baby book or something. I don't know.
So then, therefore, it's ingrained in us that we're trying to say, "No, no, this is my child. Look at the eyes. All right, look at the lack of hair.
Yeah.
We're the same thing. Same thing in common."
Makes
the adult
feel
better. I think it's part of the continuity, you know. Part of the children represents the posterity. So if you see yourself in them, then maybe they'll see themselves in you as they get older. Who knows? All right. It is very funny because that's one of the first things people ask after, of course, the weight. You know, how much does the baby weigh? Well, what difference does that make, really? It's not going to remain at that weight for that long, but all right. So those are the late Sane Hador. Okay. But of course, it's a deeper thought here as well. The Leitzanei Hador, the scoffers of the generation, were saying more than just that Avram was not Yitzhak's father. To say that Avram is not Yitzhak's father is to say that Avraham really has no heirs and there's no system of Avraham. If Yitzhak is not Avram's son, so that's to say there's no Torah and there are no mitzvos. And there's no Eretz Yisrael, there's nothing. There's a disconnect. Avram was Avram, and God maybe had a covenant with Avram, but it died with him because there's nothing that survived him. And therefore, everything is fair game. This, of course, is the big lie, and one of the big lies, and it hasn't died. It's very, very common, even today, then and now. What the Leitzanei Hador did then, trying to sever the relationship of Avram and Yitzchak, Leitzanei Hador tried to do today as well, severing our connection to our forefathers and, of course, to Eretz Yisrael as well. For how long, for example, do the Christian world say that we are not the chosen people, that God changed his covenant and the Chabtanum nation doesn't want us anymore? And in fact, early Christians call themselves New Israel. The New Israel, because we were the old defeated Israel. They said our connection to God had lapsed. That's really after this time, the first time you see such a thing. But that was the objection also to Shivat Zion. The Jewish people returned to the land of Israel. All right, what do the Arabs say? Well, these people are coming from Europe. They're coming from Arabia. What really is their connection to anything? Worse, you find that something that originated in the writings of the Nazis, but popularized in the last 30 years, is this idea that the today's Jews, especially Ashkenazi Jews, are descendants of the Khazars, you know, a tribe in the Caucasus, a Khuzari, the Sefer is based on it, that converted to Judaism in the 8th, 9th century, and they became a substantial tribe. So the argument is that we have no connection at all anymore to the land of Israel, to the people who lived in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, to this, to David and Shlomo, certainly not to Moshe, certainly not to the Avos. Now, it was made famous in a book by a wacky Jew named Arthur Kessler, a Hungarian Jew, wrote it in 1976. He was Jewish by blood, but wasn't raised Jewish at all. Had a particular animosity towards the Jewish people. He wrote a book called The 13th Tribe. The 13th Tribe, meaning that there weren't 12 tribes. Those 12 tribes are gone, and everyone that exists just a Khazar or a descendant of a Khazar. And that was the argument that he made. It was 1976. It was revived not long ago. There's a professor at Tel Aviv University named Shlomo Sand, who's a bit of an eccentric, which is another way to say a nut. And he wrote a book called The Invention of the Jewish People in the last decade, I think in 07 or 08. The invention of the Jewish people, that we are an invented people. And again, he revived the Khazar theory. And he said, of course, he still teaches at Tel Aviv University. We have no right to the land of Israel, no right to anything. He said, look, it's a practical thing. We can't go anywhere else because we'll be killed otherwise. But he's far, far to the left. And he's a little out of his mind. But he maintains that we don't really exist, all right? In fact, he followed that book with another book just a few years ago entitled The Invention of the Land of Israel. That there is no connection between the land of Israel and the Jewish people because there's no Jewish people. So therefore, what are we fighting about? Why don't we just, you know, surrender? Well, I was at the APEC summit in Dallas a couple of weeks back, and one of the sessions I attended was headed by this fellow named Bennett Greenspan. I don't know where he's from. If you Google his name, you'll see he does as a hobby. He's been involved extensively in research of the Jewish gene, especially DNA. And the latest findings, you should know, and they're fascinating. He went through slides and everything, and he does it as a service. He can charge some money for it, but if you would call him up and give him DNA, he'll tell you where you're from and who are likely your relatives across the world. His findings revealed, and he did this together with someone at the Technion, I think, that there's substantial overlap in the DNA of Ashkenazim and Sardim. Substantial overlap. And a very, very limited connection of Ashkenazi Jews, certainly Sephardic Jews, to the Khazars. Very limited. So DNA, in fact, proves there is such a thing as a Jewish gene. Mind you, we've had a lot of converts over the years also, so therefore they commingle other genes within the system. But it's so fine-tuned today, their ability to isolate the genomes and do very sophisticated analysis of a person's genetic makeup, that they're able to check the markers and see where the similarities reveal a familial connection. And it shows overwhelmingly that Ashkenazic and Sephardic Jews are really one, with one ancestor. So of course that predates the Khazars, because the Khazars have a relationship with the Jews of Arabia, and therefore we go back to the base of Mikdash. And he spoke about the Kohen gene. What's that? All right. Well, that's medieval. That came after the Khazars. That was a response to a certain situation that arose in amongst the European Jews that didn't apply. I don't even think there's rice. There was rice in the in Arabia. What?
In Eastern Europe, there was rice.
In Eastern Europe, there was rice.
I think there was.
No, there were potatoes. No, you're talking much more recently. That's why. Much more recently, but I don't think there's rice in Arabia. In any event, you see it debunks the theory. Now, of course, the whole point of what all these revisionists, including Sand, who's still alive, including Kessler, who died, actually killed himself 30 years ago, is to say that what the Arabs are saying today, if there's no connection, I mean, when I say today, I literally mean yesterday and Friday. No connection between Jews and the Beis HaMikdash. No connection between the Jewish people and the Kotel HaMaravi. No connection between the Jews and Kever Rachel and Maris HaMachpelah. Arafat maintained this theory of the Khazars very strongly because it suited his narrative. And of course, his successor follows his viewpoint on this also. And he articulates again and again that there's no connection between the Jewish people today and those to whom the land was promised, and those who resided in the land of Israel millennia ago. By the way, there's no limit to the revisionism that can take place. I just this very morning, not an hour and a half ago, I was reading today's Jerusalem Post, and it's an article that the Rasha, who's the president of Turkey, Erdogan, said in a speech yesterday that Columbus did not discover America. Muslims did at the end of the 12th century. All right? Okay, and he claims that Columbus, yeah, everything they discovered except morality. Columbus, he said, I never saw this, but he said Columbus has in his writings that when he came and he saw the coast of the Americas, was Cuba, he said, oh, there's a mosque up there on top of the hill. All right, I mean, but you know what we're dealing with now. You could say anything, you write anything, say anything, and there's an audience for it. That is also a legacy of the Leitzani Hador. But bear in mind, of course, that the connection that we have is biological, but it's not only biological. Biological connections can be severed too. As we know, there are Jews who marry out, who lose their connection to the Jewish people, And their descendants come back, and they come back as a gerim, as conversos, which you've dealt with here in Tinek, conversos. And it's not the biological connection that drives them, it's the fact that they are drawn once again, attracted once again, to the Torah of Israel, to the God of Israel, and the people of Israel. Nevertheless, the big lie continues. Rav Avinir makes a very interesting point. He says at the end of this particular paragraph that if you want to know what the connection of the Jewish people is to our ancients, he says if Socrates came to Athens today, nobody would understand a word he's saying because his Greek is not their Greek. And if Cicero went to Rome today and started to preach, nobody would listen to a word he said because he spoke Latin and they speak Italian and they're completely different languages. But if the Rambam, if Rashi walked into a modern based medrash in Israel, they pick up the conversation immediately. They just blend right in because they know exactly what they're talking about. All right? It could be, you know, as the old joke goes, the Rambam would say, I didn't mean that. That's not what I meant, you know, the way the Briskers understand him. But nonetheless, he'd be part of the conversation. And so would Moshe Rabbeinu, and so would David HaMelech, and so would Rabbi Akiva. Because we all spoke the same language. And for most part, it was either in the same land or about the same land. And therefore, that's the continuity of the Jewish people. And that's the refutation of the big lie. Vayi Yitzchak ben Arbim Shona bekachtos Rivka bas Pesuel Arami mipadan Aram achos Lavan Arami lo leisho. So Yitzchak marries. He's 40 years old. As we know, he takes the end of last week's Edra. Rivka comes, marries. Vayetar Yitzchak l'Hashem l'nochach ishtok yakorohi. Vayeoso lo Hashem v'tah Rivka ishto. Vayetar Yitzchak l'Hashem. So Yitzchak entreats God. L'nochach ishto, opposite his wife. She is barren. Vayeoser. Yeah, I should mention, Agav Urcha, I was reading the paper before, so they linked onto a video. Rav Lau, the chief rabbi, went to visit Yehuda Glick, Shabbat for Shlomo. He's the activist for Harabayit, and he was shot four times in an assassination attempt just a few weeks ago. So Rav Lau was visiting him, and one of the things he mentioned happened to be on this pasuk. What's Vayetar? Why is Vayetar an expression of tefillah? A lot of words for tefillah. But why is Vayetar? What's an atar? An atar is like a pitchfork. Tefillah means it gives you the ability, lafoch, like a pitchfork does. You upset the ground. You overturn things. Tefillah gives us the capacity to appeal to Hashem and change our fate. That's one of the beauties of tefillah. So here, Yitzhak saw, however he did, ki akarohi, that Rivka could not give birth. So what did he want? Vayetar. He wanted to take that atar and overturn that decree. That's vayeoser lo Hashem, vatar Rivka ishto. And in the end, a long period of time, it's 20 years, but in the end, God did overturn that and Rivka gave birth. So she gave birth to these two sons. They are warring with each other already in the womb. She finds it exactly that they'll represent two different nations, two different forces. These psukim we've discussed in past years. And then she gives birth. Vayitzei Rishon Admoni Kulo Ka'aderes Se'or. The first one comes out. He's completely ruddy, hairy, finished, complete. Vayikru Shmo Esav. Esav emerges from the womb, right away gets a driver's license, and goes out and gets a job. That's who he seems to be complete. Yaakov, though, is a child. Like an infant. His brother came out after. He's holding on to his brother Esav's heel. He's Yaakov. Yaakov is a normal child. Esav is not a normal child. What's not normal about Esav? Well, the Torah says, he's, the Rav said, he looks mature. He looks like he's ready to start dating. All right? He's ready to go on with his life. What does that mean, though? Aside from the physical appearance, right? So he needed a shave when he was born. That's a He's a hairy mantle. It means as a finished product, as the Rav said, no one could tell him what to do. All right? That's a personality already. It's a personality. It doesn't come about because of his physical appearance, but it comes about because of an attitude that he has. He's finished. He's Esav. Esav meaning asu, done, complete, accomplished. Someone who feels themselves to be accomplished, or feels himself to be accomplished, finished, no change is necessary, no improvements required, there's nothing to change such a child. There's nothing can teach such a child, because it's all done, it's all known. And that was Esav's downfall. We're born with a physical appearance. To a great extent, we're born with a temperament as well. Everyone has a different emotional makeup also. But nonetheless, we can control less our physical characteristics and much more our temperament and our emotional makeup and our psychological makeup. That is much more within our control. Esav didn't do that. Esav felt that being complete, he could do whatever he wants, go in the world the way he wants to go, and he has to learn nothing from anyone. Yaakov was different. Yaakov was a baby. He looked like a baby. He was a child. He was normal. What's a child then? So a child is eager, open, willing to be taught, not headstrong. So Yaakov was much more laid back, much more placid, much more homebound than Esav was, because he felt he had to learn from his parents. Esav felt the only way he could learn anything was to leave his parents' home. And at the first opportunity he did, I don't mean left, and that he didn't come home for dinner or to torment his brother, that he did. But Vayigdalu Hana'arim Vayhi Esav Ish Yodea Tzayid Ish Sadeh. As soon as they grew up, Esav became a man who knows hunting, a man of the field. What does that mean? Whatever there is to learn in life, it's going to be outside the home. His parents have nothing to teach him. As opposed to Yaakov, Ishtom, Yoshev Olim. Yaakov had a much more simple approach to life. He loved the tents. What tents? Yeah, the tents of study. But he knew he could learn first and foremost from his parents and gain from them as well. Here the Rav says as follows, and it's a very interesting point, and I think the ramifications for today are critical. The Torah gives two descriptions of Esav that are not the same. One is Ish Yodea Tzayid. He's a man that knows hunting. A hunter has to rely on himself. A hunter has to rely on his own talents, on his own ingenuity. A hunter is one who takes responsibility for success, for his failure. If he's successful, the animal is his prey, his quarry. If he's unsuccessful, occasionally the hunter loses out to the animal, especially before the days of, long-range assault rifles. The hunter can lose out because the animal might not appreciate what the hunter is offering him, which is the arrow or the sword, and therefore the hunter's dangerous. So he's a person who's active, all right? He's independent. He feels himself very powerful. He's aggressive. But he also makes his mark as Ish Sadeh. He's a person of the field. What's a person of the field? It means that his primary contribution to the world is going to be in the workplace. There he is ambitious. He's materialistic. He's intent on accumulating great wealth, money, power, possessions. That's Esav's life. So one describes his personality, his Yodea Tzayid, and the other describes his objectives to be an Ish Sadeh. He wants to make his mark out there in the world, in high finance. So the Rav writes over here that modern Western man has a lot in common with Esav, because people see their primary objective in life as, especially men, as conquering the world outside, conquering the field. And for many people, that can become an end in itself. Does it affect us? I mean, the Rav is kind enough to write about modern Western man. Does it apply to Jews? It applies to Jews v'chetzi, that people see their purpose in life as the pursuit of great wealth, of luxury, of possessions. There are also issues for us, and that makes work an end in itself. And I say this, I've known people who've done this, some are forced into it for whatever reason, but the bottom line is, if a father does not come home at night, I just assume that the mother's usually home at night. Not all mothers are home at night, by the way, today. You know, that's why you have nannies. But if a father's not home at night to see his children, and sees his children Friday night and Shabbos, he's an ish sadeh. He's not a yoshev ha'olam. He's defined his life's objective as being an ish sadeh. And that is Esav's life. That's a great chisaron. Again, we force ourselves into it because we have materialistic ambitions and desires and needs. We say that they're needs. And it costs an inordinate amount of money to live a Jewish lifestyle. But nonetheless, at a certain point, a person has to wake up and say to himself, to his wife, to his children, but most importantly to himself, am I an ish sadeh, or am I yoshev olam? Am I following the footsteps of Yaakov Avinu, or am I following the footsteps of our uncle Esav? And too many people following their uncle Esav, doesn't mean they're Rishom, chas v'shalom, they're not Rishom, they're not evil people. It's just that mentality in which a person's self-definition is going to be derived, or self-worth is going to be derived from the sadeh, and not from the OL, that becomes a terrible indictment of the way we want to live. V'Yaakov Ishtom Yoshev Olim. What's an Ishtom? He's simple. He's humble. He's content. He's comfortable remaining in the tent, studying, learning from his parents, perfecting his soul. See, Yaakov invested his energies not in the rat race, but in Avodas Hashem, as man's essence. And that's why ultimately we look to Yaakov and not to Esav. Esav had great kishronos too, had great talents. Could have used his talents for good purposes also, as the Seder goes on to teach us, as Yitzhak was hoping to do with him. But the fact is Yaakov Avinu and not Esav. There's no one alive today who speaks of Esav as Esav Avinu, right? Notwithstanding that Esav may have many more children than Yaakov Avinu has, or many more followers than Yaakov Avinu has. The nature of the Esav is to be completely independent and renounce any affiliation with that mentality, that lifestyle. But nonetheless, Esav is a dominant force. What happens as a result? Vayehav Yitzhak es Esav kitzai befiv v'rivka oheves es Yaakov. Yitzhak loved Esav, Kitzai Befiv. He was very outgoing, very physical, very strong. Now you say this, you have to repeat every year. It doesn't mean Chas V'Shalom he didn't love Yaakov. He just felt a personality connection, temperamental connection to Esav they didn't necessarily have, or had in a different way with Yaakov. And Rivko Heves as Yaakov is the same thing. Doesn't mean she didn't love Esav. But she felt a connection to Yaakov that was different. Parents sometimes bond with one child more than another. Could be, by the way, to harp back what I said earlier, could be the child who looks like them the most, or the child who has their personality, their way of looking at the world. Could be the child who is enduring whatever they endured as children, as teenagers, and the parent just feels that connection with them. God forbid, it's not a question of loving one more than the other. We should all love our children equally. It's just feeling a deeper connection to one over the other. That's what they had here. Yes?
To say about Yitzhak, though, that's why he had to stay with
him. Right.
Well, it says
Kitzayid Befiv. Kitzayid Befiv, so Chazal say it's a reference to Esav's Kibud Avahim. At least it's Kibud Av. We'll get back in a moment. But he... hunting. Tzai b'fiv, meaning it was b'fiv aviv. He always be bringing his father food. In fact, that's why in the story that plays out with Yaakov and Esav, that's what Esav did, to bring his father the matamim, the delicacies. So Esav was a very doting son. Hey, Rashi says the famous thing that he would always ask his father Shilas. You know, he pretended to be very meticulous in his observance of the mitzvahs. You wanted to say something?
Oh, me. Yeah.
Right, so if Yitzhak's in the tent learning and Yaakov's in the tent learning, that should have bonded them more than Esav. Okay, answer your question. So I'll give the answer. But some we also know to be true about parents and children. Sometimes the parent will feel a close connection to the child who is doing something the parent is not doing or wanted to do but couldn't.
So what does that say?
He's a normal person, not even an unhealthy person. It's a normal thing. You could feel an intense connection with someone who's exactly like you, or an intense connection to someone who is not like you, but is fulfilling something in life that you had to sublimate. How often do parents live through their children? Yeah, too often, by the way, but it happens. The parent always wanted to be I've seen this dozens of times. Immigrant parent wanted to be a doctor, couldn't. No money, no time to support the family, etc. But they insist that children become doctors. All right? That's that type of Ava, because... No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, was it here the intense connection or not? If you'd ask me, I would say it's more the latter than the former. It's that Esav had a life that Yitzhak did not have, because would have liked to have had.
So that might be his natural nature.
It would have been Yitzhak's nature. We don't know. It's hard to speculate.
He would like to do something.
It's hard to
sublimate it because that's natural.
It's hard to say. It's possible it's hard to say. I'll tell you a story that's interesting. It just struck me when I heard it years ago. So Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, you know, that had his masifta in Muncie, where you're from, and Saddle River Road, and he was once in his office. He was older already. He must have been in his 80s at the time. And he was looking out the window at the playground, and the kids were playing ball. And one of the rabbis happened to be with him, and he looked out, and he said to Rabbi Yaakov, look at that, it's Bittul Torah. So Rabbi Yaakov says, no, don't say that. They robbed me of my childhood. They never let me play ball. I think he was 9 or 10 when they sent Rebbe to Slobodka to learn. And he was the only one in his family, by the way, who remained religious. But he was considered an Eloi. So his parents, focused Torah on him. Wasn't saying it as a lament or as a regret. But like I mentioned on Shabbos, he was a very normal person, just a normal thing. You have to let a child be a child and a teenager be a teenager. And a man be a man and a woman be a woman. That's normal. So he felt the way he was raised was not normal. And so, am I saying he had a desire to play ball when he was in his 80s? No. But what he did was he could appreciate the fact that you have that situation. Yeah, they're not learning Torah. But to be a healthy, well-grounded person, you could have other outlets in life also. And I think that's the story here with Yitzhak and Yaakov and Esav too. I can't say. I mean, the Mepharshim argue back and forth. What did Esav, did Yitzhak love him more because he felt that Yaakov would be fine because Yaakov was exactly like him and didn't need any encouragement or doting, and Esav was not, so he had to go overboard to have that connection with Esav? Did he love Esav because Esav fulfilled something he didn't have? Did he love Esav because he felt Esav had his sublimated personality? Who knows? Doesn't matter. The bottom line is, that was the parenting choice that they made. Some criticize it. Chas v'Shalom wouldn't say it's wrong, because who knows? You only know it's right or wrong, decades later. You never know when you do something or say something. You think it's the right thing, and who knows? It turned out to be the wrong thing. At the time, you thought it was right. Who knows? But Yitzhak felt, now this is what Esav needed. Rivka, so this is what Yaakov needed. But I would never say that they didn't love their other child. That you can't say. Yes.
often in your lectures and your shiurs, you always stress very firmly that a person should not only study Torah, but they should have a profession, and they should be able to take care of their family.
Right.
And they need to do both.
Yes.
And this might be obvious to everybody except me, but it's the first time I thought that here we have twins who are showing two sides of the same person. We're showing the side of the learning, and we're showing the side of the
yes.
And it's coming from...
It's distinct also.
It's distinct. It's totally distinct.
Right.
But these two twins make up a perfect person.
Here's the perfect person. And this was Yitzhak's plan going forward in the story that's at the heart of the Sedra. Yitzhak thought they could have a partnership. They could have a perfect symbiotic relationship. Because he knew Yaakov was Yoshev HaOlam. He knew, in fact, Yaakov was the successor to the Bris Avram that everybody knew. But he also knew that Yaakov would not be able to defend himself against the Nimrods of the world like Esav did. It's in these Psukim. Esav kills Nimrod, his grandfather's nemesis. Yaakov needed a protector. Yaakov needed a supporter. By the same token, Esav needed someone who could infuse his materialistic ambitions with values. Otherwise, he would just be a hunter, a marauder, someone who killed for pleasure, or for sport, or for fun, or out of boredom. And that also couldn't be. So Yitzhak saw this as a way to bring the two of them together. Rivka intervened, because Rivka knew, apparently having lived in the home that she lived in, that Esav's nature was such that he would never be able to work together with Yaakov as a partner. That he was too independent, too ambitious, and if anything, he would crush Yaakov. So if he had received the brachos, then Yaakov would have been destroyed, and that Yitzhak had a blind spot to. That's vatichen einav. He couldn't see it. He couldn't see it for whatever reason. He couldn't see it. And that's why they had to intervene. Yes?
Yeah, actually, I once heard an opinion, or a few opinions, that say that the bechorah that Yaakov stole from Esav wasn't the bechorah of you're going to become Am Yisrael. It was the bechorah, the physical bechorah. That Yitzhak wasn't really thinking, I'm going to make Esav the father of the Jewish
right,
people.
Right, that's correct.
It was the bechorah, because when you look in the text, it's the bechorah that Yaakov stole was the bechorah of materialism, of I'm going
to
get this
right
to
be
physically work.
Yeah, to be the successor to Avram is not even Yitzhak's choice. So you see, at the end of the Sedra, it's Perek Chaf Ches Pasuk Dalid, when Yaakov is being dispatched to Padan Aram, Yitzhak says to him, "V'iten lecha es birkas Avraham, lecha ulzaracha itach." That God is v'kel shakai yivarech oscha. God should bless you, etc. V'isakalamim, v'iten lecha es birkas Avraham. God should give you the brach of Avraham, meaning the bris, Torah to Yisrael. Because that's God's choice. That's not Yitzchak's choice. So you're right. That's not the bechor here. There's one point I wanted to mention. And the kitzayt befiv. So I said that kasavor aviv shumedaktek b'mitzvahs. Rashi lo tzur or Moses aviv befiv shalo abba heich masrinus amelach asateven. He would ask his klutz kashes in order to show his frumkeit to his father. So he was deceptive, but nonetheless he was also very doting. And that Chazal emphasized that we could learn Kibud Av from Esav, the way he treated his father. So the Rav said here, that's true. What's Kibud Av aim? It's tending to their physical needs. And that, of course, is very important, and it's done while they're alive. But there's a second aspect to our relationship with our parents, and that's called Mora, reverence. Ish imo ve'oviv tiro'u. The Shabbos Osai Tishmo, beginning Parshas Kedoshim. Mora is reverence. Esav had no reverence. He had respect, but he had no reverence. What happens when you have respect and no reverence? Well, you love your parent. You bring your parent food and drink and slippers and etc. But if you have no reverence, you don't listen to them. And there's nothing you learn from them. And you don't really want to be like them. So we struggle today in the world of Kibud Av V'Aim. Mora Avaim is like a mace mitzvah. I was a little surprised. I was reading, it was about 2 weeks ago, I think, in the Wall Street Journal, an article, I think I was in Dallas when I was reading it, that there's a new trend in American life today. Children call their parents by their first names. All right? And like a girl, 12 years old, 15 years old, introduce a friend, you meet Dave. All right, Dave? Yeah, and Dave doesn't mind. All right, so what's that all about? Ever hear such a thing?
Parents want to be young.
Yeah, well, they want to be young. That's part of it. They want to be young. They want to be friends, correct? They want, exactly. They want to be pals, all right? They want to be Dave. They don't want to be father. Father sounds too authoritarian. They don't want to exercise authority. They don't want to give discipline. Because who are they? You live whatever you make. There's no morality, so do whatever you want, all right? Do whatever you want. And I'll be Dave, I'll be Jack, I'll be Bill, I'll be Mary, and, you know, I'll be Steve, whatever it is. And we will have vitiated the entire parent-child relationship. Well, that's not normal. That's not normal. It's just a symptom of what's going wrong in American society. But you see, Esav had Kibbutz on a very, very high level, but he had no mora, no reverence for his parents. And so in the end, the father, his father, had very little influence over him. To have Mora and Kibud is a very healthy combination. You bring the two together, then it sends a message to the child of love, of respect, but also of authority. And it's not just the authority of parent to child, but it invokes the authority of grandparents and great-grandparents and the ancients and the Avos and Imos, and reminds a child that he or she is not just living in the small context of our lives today, but in the much larger context of the history of the Jewish people and eternal people, part of the Bris of Avram. If a child has Mora and Kibud, that's a child who not only honors and respects and loves the parent, but that's the child who wants to learn from the parent as well. When the child wants to learn from the parent, and the parent has something to teach, so that's how we convey the Mesorah from generation to generation and remain faithful Jews. Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to say that the fact that they're both different, if each one would work on their differences, strengthen their differences, and then also be Baal Torahs, you know,
yes,
happen.
That's correct.
That Esav just was, not such a good guy.
Right.
He could have been a good guy.
Could have been.
If he
that's correct.
On it,
he had to be, his energies had to be channeled.
Right, exactly. Right.
But that's where parenting should come in.
Exactly right.
So it's really,
that's exactly.
So is it Esav's fault or is it Yitzchak's fault?
Well, we had this discussion last week also. I'm loath to blame. Look, Rav Hirsch blames them. What's that? Yes, but you know what? I think there's another important lesson here also. Right, that's correct. But there's another lesson also. You know, everyone assumes that the children are cookie cutter. They'll all be the same size, the same shape, the same texture, the same taste, right? But they're not. They're different. Some are completely different. Some are gregarious and one is shy, and some one is tall, one is short.
I have twins, you know. I'm facing it.
And identical?
I've lived it, so I know.
How different are they?
Day and night.
Day and night.
And you say symbiotic.
They're fraternal or identical?
Fraternal.
Okay, even so.
Talk about
same parents.
I mean, what one had, the other didn't have. What one, the other one had.
That's correct.
You know, it was wild.
So here the Torah is telling us, I think what you're saying, here the Torah is telling us that the children are going to be different. Some will have natures that are just so... Look, how many times have parents have said that this particular child is a pleasure to raise? Child raised himself, raised herself. And how many times the opposite happened? There's a particular child who needs increased attention, who needs extra effort, all right? Right? Yeah, that was Esav. We all know it. But that's the Torah telling us here. That was Esav and Yaakov. Again, some want to be critical of Yitzhak and Rivka. I can't do that. Who am I to say? Well, am I such a perfect parent? Yes, but that's not for now. But the fact that they did notice the differences between the children and try to steer them in the directions to which they were best suited, so that speaks well of them. That it didn't turn out the way they would have hoped, that's also part of life. And the Torah spares us none of the tsaras of the modern life. of all the Avos, you know, Avram really lost a child, Ishmael, and Yitzhak lost a child, Esav. So Yaakov, in the end, Yaakov lost a child too, if not two. Yosef and Shimon and Binyamin. But at least at the end of the day, at the end of his life, then they're all together, so they're the Shiftei Kov. But in each of our lives, we come across these situations, and it's within the Torah that we find the appropriate guidance for how to deal with them. Okay, I thank you all very much.